It is wonderful to be here tonight. I am very excited about this study. We are at a point now where we have gone through really most of the major teachings that that the book of Matthew has to offer. We're going to get into the narrative of the crucifixion and Jesus' ultimate resurrection from the dead. But this really concludes this chapter here on teaching, the teaching that we find here in the book of Matthew. So really a great accomplishment. We've done a lot of good studying, good work here in this book, and we're coming to an end. We're by no means finished, but the end is in sight. I sent out an email yesterday, I believe. As I was studying through, there's going to be a slight change in the program, if you will. Question number 5 is now question number 4. And I thought to myself as I was studying, we really need to discuss this before we need to discuss what question 5 is before we answer question 4. I thought to myself, you know, there's no hard and fast rule that says we can't do that. So we're going to have a little bit of a anarchy here tonight. And I hope everybody's just going to be okay with that, because that's what we're going to do. So we've discussed a couple of parables. We've talked about the parable of the 5 wise and 5 foolish virgins and the oil. We've talked about the servants and the talents that were given to them. And now we get into these last few verses here. And really, this is kind of an important question. If I remember right, did Malin have the last question? Okay, so this will be for Logan. Question number 1. Is this just another parable or a glimpse into the actual day of judgment? And how can we tell? Here, verses 31 through 33. When the Son of Man comes in His glory, and all the holy angels with Him, then He will sit on the throne of His glory. All the nations will be gathered before Him. He will separate them one from another as a shepherd divides his sheep from the goats, and He will set the sheep on His right hand, but the goats on the left. Is this a parable or something else?
Well, I think it's a pretty accurate description of what's going to go down. Obviously, you know, with anything, you know, that's of another dimension, we can't describe it in, you know, mere words. We can't get the accurate description of how radiant, how glorious that's going to be. But yes, I do think that that's going to be pretty accurate summation of how that's going to go down. And something else you can look at that might support that a little bit, we're going to get to it in question number 2. But he says, it'll be like goats and sheep. So he's going to go into some kind of figure of speech, some kind of metaphor like that. So.
Well said. Well said, yeah. Like I said, we'll get into that just a little bit, but that is supportive. If this is just another parable, why is he using language as what it's like? If this is already what it's like, why is there a sequence of events like that? Any other comments here on question number 1 about whether or not this is just another parable or an actual glimpse into the day of judgment? Yeah, great.
Well, it doesn't claim to be a parable. Genesis verses 1 and 14, the kingdom of heaven is like. But here it doesn't say the kingdom is like, it just says this is what's going to happen. It doesn't claim to be a parable.
Exactly, exactly. And it was interesting, some of your more liberal people, they just kind of, in fact, the picture that I had on the very first slide, I think, was titled Parable of Sheep and the Goats. But you're right. Unlike the others, it has a very definite beginning. This doesn't claim to be that. This is, it very much knows what it is. Any other comments here? Yeah, Bill.
The very first phrase, when the Son of Man comes in His glory. So this is going to be happening. So I started out, first of all, thinking, well, no, this is the judgment. And then I got to looking at, you know what, reading from different people. Then you start seeing some of these things hinting at a parable. You know, the sheep and the goats and the shepherd and those kinds of things. So I'm kind of on the fence. It could probably go down either way.
Well, you know, that is true as far as it does use some different language to describe it. And we also know from other passages that these aren't the only things that we're going to be judged on. Of course, we'll get into that a little bit later. But what kind of sealed it for me also is kind of understanding what a parable is. A parable is a common story or a common set of events that then draw a higher meaning or a higher lesson that is taught, the higher principle. So if this were in fact just a parable, we'd have to determine then what is the higher principle that's being taught here. What could possibly be higher than that of judgment itself and the final destination of our souls? Unlike the parable previous, which had definite symbolism, and then from that we can extract the higher principle as far as what he gave them talents. Well, what does a talent represent? So that's what kind of sealed it, in my opinion. But of course, other people have different thoughts on that. Anything else? Yeah, Logan.
I'm just noticing this now, looking at it up there on the screen. But the language here used is prophetic language. It says, "He will, nations will, he will again, and then he will do this." So just several, you know, prophetic, this is going to happen.
Mm-hmm. As opposed to, let's look, verse 14, the kingdom of heaven is like a man, more in the present tense or even the past tense, as opposed to the future tense. So good catch on that. Yeah, Bart.
Well, this fits in with other verses. 2 Timothy 4, verse 1, "I charge you therefore before God and the Lord Jesus Christ, who will judge the living and the dead at his appearing." So we know that this Jesus is, when he appears, going to judge the living and the dead. And this is just another way of describing that experience.
Right. Very good. Anything else here on question number one? Okay. Let's move on to question number two. This is for Bart. Why does a shepherd divide the sheep from the goats?
Well, I have to admit, I was surprised. I read this question. I was like, I know the answer to this. And then I was like, oh, I don't know the answer to this. So it was interesting studying about this to find out why this is. You know, you sort of assume that goats are bad and sheep are good. But that's not actually the way the shepherds looked at them, according to the sources at least. But there were some basic differences between the two. Sheep and goats are separated for several reasons. Goats are less resistant to cold, and sheep are more resistant to cold. And so one thing shepherds would do is they would divide the sheep from the goats at nighttime. They might intermingle during the day, but then they would divide them at nighttime and then put the goats in a warmer area. But the sheep could be in a less warm area. Also, the feeding is different. Sheep are grazers, and they tend to ramble slowly, eating along the ground, whereas goats tend to be browsers. They go for stuff that's higher up, and they move foraging for leaves, twigs, shrubs. And they're more independent than sheep. They have a tendency to wander away by themselves, whereas sheep tend to flock together. They have a flocking instinct, according to, I think it was Mike that said that. So sheep are easier to keep in a fenced area, in a closed-in area. Also, goats are less likely to respond to the master's call. And sheep are more likely to respond to the master's call. So basically, I don't know, maybe other people have other ideas, but it seems like goats just charge off, don't listen, and are less resistant to dying in the cold, and they might lead the sheep astray. And so, I don't know, that's about all I that's about all I was able to come up with. And it's interesting that the sheep go to the right hand, which is the hand of distinction and honor, but the poor goats go to the left. And you know, nobody wants to be a goat. You know, we would like to be sheep and be on God's right hand. So, and interesting. I'm curious about what other people discovered. So.
Very good. Feel like a zoology course right there. That's, any other comments here on question number two and why someone would divide sheep from goats? Well, I like what Clark said. I'll just add this. He says, it does not appear that sheep and goats were ever penned or housed together, like Bart said. Though they might feed in the same pasture, yet even this was not done but in separate flocks. Sheep, which have ever been considered as the emblems of mildness, simplicity, patience, and usefulness, represent here the genuine disciples of Christ. This is what I found fascinating. Goats, which are naturally quarrelsome, lascivious, and excessively ill-scented, were considered as the symbols of riotous, profane, and impure men. They here represent all who have lived and died in their sins. I found that humorous. But I think the depiction is correct as to why he talks about here sheep and goats. And I think we'll get into that as we look here in these verses. As opposed to the ones who follow after Christ, are contrasted with those who really just go in their own way. Those who are looking for the shepherd and wanting to follow after the shepherd are contrasted with those who, as Clark put it, are quarrelsome, lascivious, and excessively ill-scented. Any other comments here on question number two? Yeah, Logan.
This could be reaching maybe a little too far with goats and sheep, but if you've ever been around a goat or messed around with a goat, you know that they're extremely, extremely skittish. They've got those eyes that are kind of rectangular, like parade eyes. Mm-hmm. And so they're always scared. It doesn't matter how close you are to them, how often you spend time with them, they still think you're like this enemy that's coming to kill them. Whereas, sheep, they have this calm demeanor, they come to their shepherd. So, yep. Just a little bit extra there.
Yeah,
I don't know if that's useful.
I think it is. I think it, again, when you're talking about those who are evil, as is the case here, or those who were ultimately judged evil, that's the type of life that they have. They don't recognize the one who is their protector, their guardian, like you're talking about, the one who actually wants to take care of them. Every time they see him, like what you're talking about, they get scared. They don't know what to do with him. They think he's a stranger. Unlike the sheep who know the shepherd knows the sheep. There's a relationship there. There's no such relationship, historically speaking, with goats. There may have been one goat one time that was much beloved by his owner, but for the sake of the illustration here, we're not going to include that particular goat. Yeah, Bill.
One more thing. I found out, I think it was Kaufman. Kaufman pointed out that Plato's Republic depicts the unjust being ordered to take the down road to the left. So that's kind of, I don't know how that fits, but to the left, here you go again. The unjust are going to the left.
Right. Correct. Yes. That, they, again, talking about the right and the left, we know that Jesus, when he ascended into heaven, sat down at the right hand of God. And that's, of course, we know the place of honor. And I think it was Ecclesiastes 10, verse 2. I know I wrote it down somewhere, but I don't think I have it in my notes. But it talks about the righteous go to the right, but the wicked to the left in some sort of fashion. Let's just turn over there real quick. Maybe I'm wrong, maybe I'm right. We will see. It's Ecclesiastes chapter 10, verse 2. It says, a wise man's heart is at his right hand, but a fool's heart at his left. So that's a little bit of symbolism there in the right and the left hand in that. So any other comments here on question number two? We'll go ahead and move on. Okay, question number three. Oh, this is... we've already been through that. Okay, question number three. This will be for Landon. According to these verses, what are we going to be judged on? Are these the only things that we will be judged on? And why did Jesus mention these things specifically? There's a lot in there, but...
So in our study, to answer the first part of the question, we had a quote from Criswell in his commentary where he says, Jesus shows the way we serve him is by serving others. Each of these acts is a work of benevolence done to our fellow man. When we minister to the needs of those who are hungry, thirsty, without lodging, ill-clad, and in prison, we demonstrate a spirit of goodness that can be identified only with Christ.
So that answer is the first part. The second part, are these the only things that we will be judged on? The answer is obviously no. We have a verse for this in James 2, starting in verse 14. There it reads, "What does it profit, my brethren, if someone says he has faith but does not have works? Can faith save him? If a brother or sister is naked and destitute of daily food, and one of you says to them, 'Depart in peace, be warm and filled,' but you do not give them the things which are needed for the body, what does it profit? Thus also faith by itself, if it does not have works, is dead." And then skipping down to verse 22 in that same chapter, where it's talking about Abraham, it says, "Do you see that faith was working together with his works, and by works faith was made perfect?" So we can see that faith and works are not mutually exclusive. You have to have both of them. And for the third part, why did Jesus mention these things specifically? He mentioned them specifically because it's a necessity for us to have as Christians.
Very good. Very good. I agree 100% with that. Anybody else? Laura?
Verse 32 says all nations will be judged. So perhaps this means Christians from all nations. But it seems to me more likely, as I thought about this question, that it seems to mean all nations, all people from all time. And all people from all time will be judged. Then we see it's judged on how we treated the king. So the king is Jesus, or the Lord, verse 37, or the Son of Man, verse 31. So these things, we have food, they're acts of mercy, food and water, verses 35 and 36, clothing and companionship, verses 36 and 37. And these are things that people universally understand. Even if you're an atheist, you might be on a human rights commission and you would point to these things as being good, bad. They're things that heathens know, Romans 1. So, you know, and it is the focus of the law, if you look at Micah 6:8, and it's the focus for Christians, Matthew 5, 17 through 48, these higher, the purpose, you know, at the Beatitudes, when Jesus talks about the purpose behind the law and what's going forward. So these are universal things people should know kind of throughout all time. It kind of gets into one of your later questions, I think. So.
Yeah. Very good. Appreciate that take. Any other comments here on question number 3? Well, I'll throw out some things that I was looking at here. Again, it kind of gets into really the next question that we're going to look at a little bit. I think it's partially, these things are mentioned specifically partially because of the context and really the verses previous to this, as far as you might remember Matthew 24, where it talks about kind of a parable there of the foolish servant or the evil servant is the one who beats his fellow servants, and then he's eating and drinking with the drunkards, as kind of a picture of the person there who doesn't treat his fellow man, his fellow servants more specifically, in a correct way. And I think this somewhat highlights that, so there's a possibility there. Also, where is it? Yes. There's another part of Criswell's quote that he had that I thought was particularly good. He said in verse 36, the phrase, "Ye clothe me," literally means to cast something around. "Visited me" means to come to see or to look after. Thus, a hands-on Christianity is implied. It's not enough to rely on the goodness of others to meet the needs of our brethren. We must be involved personally. Neither is it enough to cast our offering into the treasury and expect the church to do our benevolence. Each will be judged on his own works. So I thought that was a good thought there. And some verses kind of back that up there. Again, For you must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, that each one may receive the things done in the body according to what he has done, whether good or bad. So that's why the first part of this question, that's why we're going to be judged on these things, what we actually did. Yeah?
The verse that we had studied a few weeks ago, Matthew 20, verse 28, Jesus said, just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life a ransom for many. That answers that first part, according are these the only... This question about service, this question about service to our brother. Mm-hmm. I really like Matthew 20:28.
Yeah. I didn't have that up there, but I probably should have. That's a good verse. Landon already mentioned there, James 2:26. It's not the only thing that's going to save us is benevolent good works, but it's emblematic of the faith that we have. Faith without works is dead. Also, even as the Spirit is, and again, Chris Wells' quote there. Any other comments here on question number 3? Yeah, great.
I kind of saw this as being essentially part of several examples of a pattern of good works, as is mentioned in Titus 2:7. We're supposed to show a pattern of good works. These are just essentially examples along this line, if you want to think of it like as an equation. We kind of know all the things along this line are part of these good works. This is just a couple of examples along that line.
Very good. Very good. Yeah, Bart.
And I mentioned that doctrine's important too. I didn't have time to find the verse, but Paul admonishes Timothy to pay attention to the doctrine by which you will save both yourself and others. And Paul tells the Thessalonian brethren, keep the traditions as they have been delivered to you. So in addition to taking care of our brethren and doing works of benevolence and having faith as a mission, we have a responsibility to hold to the true faith that's been delivered to us. As you've been pointing out in Galatians, you could lose your faith by listening to a false gospel and obeying that false gospel, turning aside from the truth.
Mm-hmm. And there's no amount of benevolent works that can save you from that. Anything else? Okay, let's move on to the next question here. This is formerly question 5, but is now question number 4. Who are the least of these? And why does the Lord put such importance upon how they are treated? And that's verses 40, where it's mentioned in verse 45. Levi.
So as for the first part of the question, who are the least of these? I think it's our fellow brethren. And for the second part of the question, well, actually, first, let's go into the reasoning why I think that. Give me a second here. So it could be translated followers or countrymen. So I don't know, it seems the most logically and with the context, it would be brethren. So for the second part, why does the Lord put such importance on how they are treated? Obviously, this takes place at the end of time, so this is going to be said to us. And when you think about it, so I've never clothed anybody, I've never visited anybody in prison, I've never done any of those things, so how does that translate? I know one way it could translate is how my parents feed and clothe me. They don't visit me in prison, but...
Which is great. We hope they never do.
I think the main way this can be interpreted for us as 21st century Christians is there are a lot of ways we can encourage and clothe and feed our brethren spiritually, because it's a very, very confusing world we live in. And if they come to church and they see that we're having a good time, we're happy to worship the Lord, I feel like that can feed them. And we all need nourishment, we all need encouragement. Just like, is it Barnabas?
Mm-hmm.
Who was the encourager? I certainly need to be better at that. But
very good, yeah. Very good. I think, I don't know if this is exactly what you meant, Grant, or not, but I'm going to take it this way. You were talking about a pattern of good works. And just because it talks about these things specifically, doesn't mean that these are the only good works that we could ever do. Just like you're saying, there's other ways that we can help people, whoever that might be. So yeah, very good. Any other comments here on question Now, number four, as to who the least of these. Yes, Lauren.
I'll take an alternative view of this. We could look at it as our brethren. It says, verse 40, least of these, my brethren. But again, kind of back to the point of the previous one, I think it means every human. Luke, in the parable of the Good Samaritan, Luke 10:30-37, the question was, who is my neighbor? And there it showed that every person is your neighbor. So why is that important? Genesis 9:6, for in the image of God, he made man. And again, we see also that Jesus came to this earth, and he lived life as a man, and he underwent all these sufferings to show us, you know, how that is, and so you can have sympathy with those type of things.
And that's honestly very good. I think it was Barnes that was talking about the facts, and I may actually have it up here. I don't remember if I put it in my slide or not. But that when it describes my brethren, that it could mean either those of the church. His take was that it could also mean those who are fellow partakers in his sufferings or his earthly plights that he went through. So that's not an outlandish take. Any other comments here on who the least of these are? Yeah, Bill.
Yeah, I went a little different, but I mean, more like what Levi was talking about. I was thinking it was brethren, verse 40, and I was thinking of maybe brethren that were downtrodden. And this particular time, I mean, this would have been, there was a lot of people barely getting by in this particular time. You know, you think about today, there's not that many people downtrodden today, but we can still do good works. But I was thinking, and I used James chapter 2, verses 1 and 5, you know, showing the preference to the high roller versus the downtrodden, and something that we need to be attentive to.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Any other comments here? Okay. I'll get into my thoughts here. For one, Jesus does call his disciples brethren, Hebrews 2:11. Very last part there, he is not ashamed to call them brethren. And again, Matthew 12, verse 50, whoever does the will of my Father in heaven is my brother and sister and mother. So he does use this type of language. Our brethren are the primary focus. And I think Galatians 6, verse 10 is a great verse for that. It says, therefore, as we have opportunity, let us do good to all, especially to those who are of the household of faith. Romans 12:10-13, it says, be kindly affectioned to one another with brotherly love and honor, giving preference to one another, distributing to the needs of the saints, given to hospitality. 1 John 3:17, whoever has this world's goods and sees his brother in need and shuts up his heart from him, how does the love of God abide in him? Again, that's the brother in James 2:15, if a brother or sister is naked and destitute of daily food. So that whole section there in James 2, 14 through 24. All of that is talking about brethren. That's the context that he gives. Now, that does not mean that we don't have any obligations to those outside the church, as other verses prove. Again, Galatians 6, verse 10. Let us do good to all. Luke 6:35, love your enemies, do good and lend, hoping for nothing in return. If they're your enemy, then we might have enemies in the church, but we're also most definitely going to have enemies outside the church. We're told to do good and lend, hoping for nothing in return, and your reward will be great. And again, Hebrews 13, verse 16, do not forget to do good and to share, for with such sacrifices God is well pleased. So there's ample evidence that we're supposed to do both of these things. I think the primary thing here in Matthew 25 is talking to brethren. Because that's what he says there in verse 40. But that doesn't negate the fact that we're supposed to be doing good things to all people. Is that... So a few of the commentators here. These were least, Criswell says, because of their poverty and little apparent importance. Christ identifies himself not merely with the distinguished, but with those whom men would esteem lightly. I thought that was good. Kaufman had some great things here. He says, it's not mere charity, but help of Christ's followers that is highlighted here. If this principle were more widely understood and accepted, it would revolutionize men's attitude toward the church. In the final essence, what men do to his church, they do to him. To neglect, flout, or dishonor the church is to do the same to Christ, who is the head of the church. On the other hand, those who support and provide for the church and extend their concern and constant aid upon behalf of her poor and needy do the same for Christ, whose body is the church. And again, Barnes' thought here on the phrase, my brethren, either those who are Christians, whom he condescends to call brethren, or those who are afflicted, poor, and persecuted, who are his brethren and companions in suffering and who suffer as he did on earth. So, again, I didn't think that was an outlandish take. I prefer to think that this is talking about brethren in Christ, but I don't know that I could just nail down for sure that that would be the case. Is there any other comments here? We actually need to get going. No other comments. Question number five. This will be for Bill. How important are acts of benevolence, and what should we do to ensure that we are performing these acts at every opportunity, and who should we see when we do perform these things?
Well, question 4A, how important are acts of benevolence? I believe that they can determine our eternal fate. In as much as you did it to least of these. Question number two, what should we do to ensure that we are performing these acts at every opportunity? Well, we need to be ready, and we need to watch. We need to watch for opportunities to help our brothers and sisters. And I know we have people that do that here. I can think of when Ray was in the hospital and folks bought food, and you know, sisters are doing that kind of thing. And I mean, but the point is, kind of like what maybe I think it was Levi, it might have been Landon talking about, you know, you can do other good things, not just what's here. So there's a takeaway. Now, what you had up there about with Kaufman and that comparison, you know, you do it to the least of these, you've done it unto me. Okay. I found myself thinking about this point that about Christ being served. It's through our service to his children. When we do service to his children, it's as if we're doing service to Christ. What happens when we're rude to one another, disrespectful to one another? We're doing that to Christ. You know, I hadn't thought of that before. So, you know, I think we all need to pay attention. We need to be careful about how we think and how we talk.
Very good. Very strong point. Yeah, Levi.
I also think when you put these versus goggles on, the sin of backbiting becomes a lot worse. Just because of when you're in the church and you are doing that to a brother, you are doing it to Christ. And it's not something that helps anybody. And it makes it seem so much more sinister when you put it through these verses.
Mm-hmm. It really does. And really the response of the wicked are just that, oh, we didn't see you, Lord, we didn't see your holiness. If we had saw you, things would have been different. But you know, all we saw was just these other little peons over here that they weren't really worth that much. If we actually look at our brethren and we see the Lord, as he talks about here, it should change our perspective. It does look a lot more sinister in that way. Other comments? Yeah, Grant.
Let's say one more thing. I think the attitude also that which we do these things is also very important. I don't think Jesus wants us to do these things and have a poor attitude and say, oh, I had to help somebody. I think he wants us to have a cheerful attitude and not complain about it at all.
You're right. Absolutely. If you're just doing them because you feel obligated to do them, I think this is symbolic or emblematic of people who have the right attitude within themselves. It's a lifestyle. Wherever they see the opportunity, they seize upon the opportunity. It's not just that they were roped into an opportunity, but they're actively looking for that opportunity. Lauren?
Just two verses that address the very first part of the question. How important are they? 1 John 4:20-21. If someone says, I love God and hates his brother, he is a liar. For he does not love his brother whom he, for he who does not love his brother whom he has seen, how can he love God whom he has not seen? And this commandment we have from him, that he who loves God must also love his brother.
Very good.
And then one of my favorite verses. But I'm going to back up 2 verses this time. Micah 6, back up to verse 6. With what shall I come before the Lord and bow myself before the high God? Shall I come before him with burnt offerings of calves a year old? Will the Lord be pleased with the thousands of rams, 10,000 rivers of oil? Shall I give my firstborn for my transgression, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? He has shown you, O man, what is good. And what does the Lord require of you but to do justly, to love mercy, and walk humbly?
Very good. Very good. Other comments here? Logan.
Just super, super quick. Going off of Levi's point a little bit, and Bill's as well, just with doing the bad deeds to your brothers is doing that to Christ. We go into 2 Corinthians chapter 13, verse 5. It says, "Examine yourselves to see whether you are in the faith. Test yourselves. Do you not realize that Christ Jesus is in you? Unless, of course, you fail the test." So, we are meant to have Jesus in us, and that compounds what we're talking about here.
That's right. Great verse. Any other comments? One thing that kind of came to my mind, I think a lot of times when we talk about doing good works and benevolent works, we always mention the fact, not incorrectly, but we mentioned the fact that, well, we live in a country that has a lot of social programs, that has a lot of safety nets, so we don't see the type of poverty that they saw back then. We don't see as many beggars on the street. We don't see as many poor and handicapped people like they would have back then. So maybe our opportunities are limited because of what the government does. And the thought that kind of ran across my mind is the fact that, well, that means that we have to give more than the government does. We also have to do it quicker than the government does. If we think that just because the government is out there, that, well, they'll be taken care of eventually, that's the wrong way to look at it. That's not us actively looking for those opportunities. And if Christians can't move faster than the government or the insurance company, then that really says something about us. But also, again, what we've been talking about here tonight, it's not just money. It's not just food. It's not just clothing or just water. Interesting, when it talks about those who are sick and those who are in prison, we have something to give that's more valuable than money, and that's our time. That's our attention. That's those type of efforts that we can give to other people that are just as important, in fact, far more valuable than what money is. For me, for any of us to listen to someone who's going through a hard time, people already pay a whole lot of money for someone like that, and sometimes not even with great results. But how much more important is it for brethren? And, you know, even for those outside of the church, I don't think it's exclusively that we can only do these things for the brethren, but especially for the brethren. We should be giving things much more valuable than money. Any other comments here before we get to our last question? Okay. Hunter, this last question is for you. Number 6. Who was hell initially prepared for? And how can it be fair that the wicked receive the same punishment as the devil himself?
I think, at least in the first part of the question, if you're reading the verse, prepared for the devil and his angels. No, obviously the devil. And then what angels actually means is, you know, up to a fair amount of faith, whether that's actual angelic beings or servants of the devil and so on and so forth. To take this down. But the interesting thing is verse 34, you have this kingdom that has been, that is prepared for these people, for the righteous. It's been intentionally prepared for them. And on the left,
have this kingdom, if we're taking a look, looking it through the lens of prepared for the devil, these angelic beings, not human beings, you have this other kingdom on the left that's literally prepared for these other types of beings, not human beings. And so you're going to inherit that thing. That's how far that you fell down, as opposed to, you know, staying human as you should have been and inheriting that thing that was designed for you to get on the right-hand side. And so I think that kind of answers the question in the second part, how can it be fair? Because people fall that far, because they've become servants of the devil through their actions, or I guess in the case of this, these verses here, the lack of their actions.
Very good. That's exactly right. Any other comments here on question number 6? You know, as far as it being fair or not, you know, actually, really, the first part of the question should give us a lot of comfort and a lot of trust in God, because what he did prepare for humans was heaven. What he did not prepare for wicked humanity was hell. That was prepared for the devil and his angels. God wants better for us, but ultimately when we sin, in the similar fashion as the devil himself sinned, he committed the sin of rebellion. And again, with the image here of the sheep and the goats, goats over and over again, everyone that talked about goats, and I'm sure Bill would agree from his experience with goats, they're rebellious little critters. And so very similar to us, whenever we sin against God, that's us rebelling. And that's us falling to the same sin, the same level, if you will, that the devil himself fell to. So it's not prepared for us. We didn't inherit it. It doesn't say there that you have inherited hell, unlike those who have inherited the kingdom prepared from the foundation of the world. They didn't inherit that, but that's what they received nonetheless. And then this one last little quote here. This was in Criswell's commentary, which is a quote from a man named Fowler, paraphrasing this response that the wicked gave, and I thought it was really great. In essence, they're saying, had we been granted the privilege to serve you, we would have been more than glad to do so, but we never met anyone that even closely resembled you, just miserable wretches whom it was useless to befriend, a shabby old woman, a waif too skinny to adopt, all situations too trifling to take seriously, you understand. I thought that was pretty good. That's exactly what they're saying. And as opposed to the surprise of the righteous, they both have the same response. Well, we didn't see you like this. The righteous may be unaware of the actions, unaware of the how good their good works actually are, what kind of impact those things actually had. The righteous, or the wicked rather, are looking at it through a much different lens as, well, if we had actually seen you, we would have done something, but we didn't see you. We didn't see anything worth doing. And we're just about out of time. Is there anybody else who has a comment here on this last question? If not, let's conclude this study here tonight. I appreciate everyone's participation in study.